Welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. As always, I'm your host, Matt Calder, and on today's show, we'll be speaking with Brian Balfour of the Civitas Institute about Medicaid expansion, and more specifically, we'll be talking about Medicaid expansion as one of the wish list items or the agenda items of the left, and specifically as part of the Civitas Institute's new Toxic Agenda series, where they will be highlighting different pieces of the left's agenda and why the certain of those things are bad ideas, and they can be across different policy areas, but the whole overarching connection being that they are agenda items of the left that would not be good for our state in the opinion of conservatives. And those will be available on nccivitas.org on the Civitas Institute website. And then we're going to talk with Brooke Medina and Ray Notstein, who've been on the show before individually, but never together. And we're going to come on to talk about the death penalty. And this is a topic that's come up in relation to the call, or come up because of the call from state leaders in the House and Senate to resume carrying out the death penalty in light of the murder of three corrections officers and a prison work program manager at the Pastor Tank Correctional Institute, with the DA saying he will seek the death penalty in those cases. If we're not using the death penalty, the question is, does it really mean anything? And really, we're going to be talking about whether or not there should be a death penalty either, or talking around that issue, really, in on this segment with Ray and Brooke. So you're really going to want to listen into that discussion because, as you know, people care about that a lot on both sides when it comes to whether or not the state should be in the business of killing people. There's a lot of feelings on both sides of the issue, and you're going to want to check out that segment. But before we get to that, I want to talk about our sponsor for the show. The show, as all the past shows have been, is sponsored by the Civitas Institute. That is North Carolina's conservative voice. And to find out more about what they have going on, go to nccivitas.org, where you will be able to find out more. Also, subscribe to this show if you're not already. If you're listening on the airwaves, on the real radio, the FM radio or AM radio, then you are hearing the show earlier than everyone else who gets it on Monday, but you are having to listen to it then and there at that time or in your region. But that's not the only way to get the show. You can also subscribe or listen to the show online on the website at freedomactionnetwork.com, where the rest of the archives of the show are, or you could subscribe to the show and listen to it on your phone or your iPad and get it to your device automatically. And to do that, go into, whether you're an Apple user, go into Apple Podcasts. If you're an Android user, download one of the many podcasting apps to your phone and use that one. But all you have to do is search What Matters in North Carolina and subscribe to the show, and it will show up automatically and immediately when it goes up. It will show up to your device, and you'll be able to listen to it at your leisure. Now, also, we want you to subscribe to the show, we want you to also follow along with us on social media, and so we can hear from you there, or you can hear from us from what we're passing on during the week outside of the show. And to do that, just go on Facebook and Twitter at To What Matters NC on Facebook and Twitter, and you can like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and get some more information from us there. But we also want to hear from you literally. We want to hear from you on social media, but we want to hear from you literally with our call-in line. That's 919-747-8063. Again, that's 919-747-8063. And you can use that call-in line to leave us messages in about a minute or two, keep it clean and concise, and about something you want to talk about or want us to talk about, some segment we did that you have a comment on, call that number. Again, that's 919-747-8063. Leave us a message, and if it's good, we'll play it on the air. So, for example, you could say you're Matt from Clayton, and you want to talk about Medicaid reform. If you hear this segment and have something you want to talk about, on the next show, we'll play it on the air. Again, if it's good, clean and concise. And without any further ado, we will get to our segment with Brian Balfour. All right, Brian, thanks for joining us on the show again.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Oh, glad to have you, and kind of get something going on in between this holiday, you know, in between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and knock out another segment with you. It's been a while since we've had you on the show, I think. It's been a few weeks.
Yeah, a few weeks, so I'm glad to be back.
Oh, yeah, and I said it's good to have you. So today we're talking about Medicaid expansion, but really through the lens of a project that the Civitas Institute has undertaken recently, right? And can we that's the case?
Yeah, we're starting to put together some articles looking at the left's true agenda for North Carolina. You know, I think it's important to remind people, you know, now that, you know, there's been Republican majorities in the both chambers of the legislature, you know, the left just hasn't gone away. Their ideas are still out there. They still have agendas that they want to push. And so, you know, we're always one election away from them once again being in charge and being able to advance their agenda. So what we're trying to do is cobble together a series of articles looking at, you know, exactly what are some of the things that they would impose on North Carolina if they were once again to regain power. And you know, one of the things that I was talking about in an article this last week is talking about Medicaid expansion in North Carolina.
Right. And so the overarching, I guess, project is what's the name of that project again?
Well, it's the Toxic Agenda. It's being put together as we speak. We hope to soon have a dedicated webpage for it on our website and so forth. So right now, you know, we're putting together some articles and gathering the information and in order to start to organize that in one unified place here in the very near future.
Right. And so this is not one policy area, right? This is multiple areas of policy with the common tie being it's the agenda of the left, the things that maybe aren't right in front of you right now or right in front of everyone's face because, as you said, Republicans are in power in the legislature up until the last year in the governor's mansion as well. So maybe they're not right in the forefront, but they're still there being tinkered away at as much as they can, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, there's still legislation that's being introduced. Of course, it's not going anywhere right now because of the leadership in the legislature. But, you know, it's really kind of an open secret. You know, they continue to introduce these bills to really signal what their agenda, priorities are, and what they would try to impose on North Carolina, you know, should they regain power. And so that's really kind of the point of the article. And it's not just one issue area. I mean, as I mentioned, you know, the latest one is on Medicaid expansion. There's other issues about education, issues about light rail funding that we had talked about, I think, the last time I was on. There's going to be just really the whole, you know, spectrum of issues that they want to try to impose. And this is going to be an ongoing project that will be continued to be added to over, you know, in the year to come.
Right, that sounds like it's going to be very informative. Definitely, it sounds like there's going to be a lot of kind of policy, you know, kind of behind the scenes, you know, informative stuff there. Really, people who do care about the nuts and bolts will be able to kind of get into and get more than just the headlines on the major newspapers, you know.
Yeah, absolutely, and we're gonna provide analysis as to why these ideas would have a negative impact, what the impact would be on North Carolina, and also talk a little bit about conservative alternatives as well. It's one thing to just criticize, but it's another thing to try to create or generate and discuss alternatives as well. And that's what we provide in the articles also.
Yeah, that's good, though, because that's the thing I've heard is, you know, you better not highlight a problem if you don't have a solution. Like, don't tell me what's wrong if you don't have an idea for what we can do differently or better.
Yeah. So the old phrase, you know, criticize by creating, you know, so you create the alternative, talk about what's better. If you're going to be critical, talk about and create something better. And that's certainly part of what this series is going to entail also.
Well, good deal. So let's dive in. So this is Medicaid expansion, or the left wanting to expand Medicaid, and kind of that's been definitely pushed back and not been done over the last, I mean, how many years have they been pushing for?
Yeah, really going back about 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. So, but kind of give a quick, I guess, the dime tour about how, about where we are now.
Yeah, absolutely. So, even this past year, in 2017, in the legislative session, there was bills introduced in both the House and the Senate, House Bill 858, Senate Bill 290. That would expand Medicaid here in North Carolina, really as provided by in the Obamacare legislation. And just kind of the short version of it is that these bills would include in North Carolina, expanding the state's Medicaid program to everyone under age 65 not currently eligible for Medicaid, but earning up to 133% of the federal poverty level. But analysis shows what that really equates to or amounts to is putting lots of able-bodied, working-aged, childless adults onto the Medicaid rolls. You know, Medicaid traditionally, the targeted populations to serve has been, the disabled, children from low-income homes, pregnant women. So this would really be a pretty broad expansion into a new population of people. And there's some concern that the expansion would kind of start to crowd out resources going to those traditional, more vulnerable Medicaid populations. So that's certainly one concern as what as part of the expansion. But one of the things that I really dive pretty deep into in the article is talking about how coverage does not equal access to care. The left always wants to talk about how it's just so compassionate. You know, we want to extend Medicaid coverage to these people, you know, make sure that they're taken care of when they get sick and they don't have any worries in terms of their health issues. The problem is when you look at the numbers, though, North Carolina's Medicaid program is already overcrowded. For example, I look at the numbers and it was really kind of even a little bit stunning to me when I started looking at it. For example, if you go back to 2003, North Carolina's Medicaid program had about 1 million enrollees. Fast forward to today, that's more than doubled. There's about 2.1 million people on North Carolina's Medicaid program. And keep in mind now, here's the kicker, that during that same time period, the number of physicians enrolled as Medicaid providers actually dropped by nearly 30%. So you're talking about literally more than a million new people in the Medicaid program in North Carolina, and there's 10,000 fewer doctors available to see them. So, I mean, what do you think that does to access to care? You know, who do these people see when they get sick? You know, how do they have a regular, you know, family physician? And so this legislation, and looking at the legislation introduced this past summer, their estimates said that Medicaid expansion would add another 630,000 people to this program in the next year and a half to 2 years. So, I mean, we're talking that would balloon it up to about 2.7 million people, again, chasing fewer doctors.
And that's just in the state?
That does not mean access to care. That's just in North Carolina's Medicaid program.
I mean, that's such a large portion of the state if you think about it. I mean, that's a shocking amount of people in making up the state to be on that.
That would push it probably to be more than one out of four North Carolinians to be on the Medicaid program. I mean, think about that for a minute.
See, that I would think a picture of a state that had one in four people on government medical assistance would not be the prosperous state that North Carolina is. That seems incongruous to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not only is it not good for the enrollees because they really lack access to care, and also studies have shown that health outcomes for Medicaid enrollees oftentimes is no better, sometimes even worse than people with no health insurance. So they're not getting access to care. The health outcomes are not being improved. And from an economic perspective, looking at the state of North Carolina's economy, it would cost the state tens of thousands of jobs for a couple of reasons, and research backs this up. Of course, there's the poverty trap. When you get people on Medicaid, I mean, that's a very valuable benefit. I mean, that's difficult to replace financially. So if you're someone in that position, then and you're dependent on the government for that medical care or that medical coverage, then you have a chance to, if you're unemployed, you have a chance to get a job, or maybe you have a chance to get a better job, a more high-paying job. If you're already currently employed, you risk losing those benefits if you increase your income. So in the end, if you make that decision to get a job or find a better job or work more hours, you're actually going to end up financially worse off than you were before. So that kind of traps people in that cycle of dependency, because you know, rationally in the short term, you're not going to want to make yourself financially worse off by accepting that job, that promotion. The downside to that, of course, is the longer you stay unemployed or the longer you delay, you know, trying to acquire higher levels of skills and training in the workforce, then the less employable you're going to be in the long term. So it's just kind of keeps people trapped in a vicious cycle. So it's going to cost people, or it's going to cost North Carolina tens of thousands of jobs. It's going to be harmful to the economy, and it's going to make healthcare overall even more expensive. Because again, research shows that people on Medicaid are more likely to utilize the highly expensive emergency room services even than the uninsured. Because in no small part because they can't find a doctor, as we were just talking about. So when they get sick, where else are they going to go to care? Well, they're going to go to the ER, and it largely costs them nothing financially. So and of course that just drives up the cost in the system then. And then the costs are passed on and higher premiums to the folks that are insured. and again, it just perpetuates this vicious cycle that makes health insurance less affordable. You know, fewer people can afford insurance. It draws more people into the Medicaid rolls then. And it just keeps perpetuating itself and just growing and growing.
And wouldn't it also increase congestion and wait times at the ER itself? I mean, the ER is ultimately, it's an emergency room, or emergency departments, as they call them in a lot of places now, but it is ultimately for emergencies. And anybody going there for a non-emergency clogs up that system, I would think.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Which isn't the primary concern with all this, but it is an ancillary.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, it's a significant concern. And one of the things that I included in my article is talking about how emergency rooms are not prepared for an influx of additional patients utilizing their services. You know, there's doctor shortages overall. There's not enough resources and people available to staff the ER to handle an influx. There was a survey I cited in there that said, I think about 70% of ER staffers surveyed in this medical survey for a medical journal, said 70% said they are not prepared for any sort of significant increment or increase in their ER usage. And so, again, you know, coverage does not mean access to care. So we're going to be putting these people, giving these people a Medicaid card. They're going to struggle to find a regular physician, a regular doctor to go to. So when they get sick, they're going to resort to the emergency rooms, which are going to begin to become more and more overcrowded because they're not equipped to handle it. So that means longer wait times, less access to care even on that end, and again, driving up the expenses for the healthcare system overall in the state.
Right. And so you've mentioned a few different reasons why, you know, why Republicans and conservatives wouldn't want this to happen. But I feel like you're missing one. You're not saying the obvious reason that I've gathered from looking at what the protests have said, the Moral Monday protests, and that Republicans hate people, or conservatives hate people, that they don't want people to have access to health care. I mean, where is that reason?
Yeah, that's buried pretty deep in my notes, I guess. But you know, that kind of stuff is of course just total nonsense, and it's really kind of, it makes those people look weak. You know, that's the best argument you can come up with. You really think that people that even in the face of presenting all this kind of evidence and arguments and reasons for why it's actually going to harm the people, the very people you claim to help, still the best thing you say, well, your best comeback is to say, well, you just hate people and want sick people to die. Well, I mean, are you serious right now? It makes you look incredibly weak and really signals that you are not interested in having a serious discussion.
Right. What it makes me think about is, and kind of when you're a kid and an adult tells you not to do something, there's a reason. And a lot of those times, if you were a kid, like I was a kid, it was because you're doing something dangerous. You know, go around the horse fence. Don't crawl under the horse fence. You're going to get shocked. And did I keep doing it? Yes, I did. And I got shocked a certain amount of times as a kid, probably more than the average kid. But that's one of countless examples of things that I didn't understand as a kid, why they wouldn't want me to do something, thinking, oh, it's just not, you just don't want me to have fun. when it's completely not about that. And then you get older, you have the aha moment. Oh, you don't want me jumping over this 6 foot deep dish or a 6 foot deep ditch when I'm a kid because I could fall down into this thing, hurt myself, and drown in the creek that's in the bottom of the ditch. I mean, you don't want me to go swimming alone out in the middle of the woods in a pond because I could drown out there. I mean, there's obvious reasons when you're older, smarter, more mature. And it seems like the people who are saying Republicans hate people. They don't want people to have medical care. They're just stingy for no reason. They don't care about people. It seems like they're stuck in that, you know, not being able to see outside of the one little thing that they want. It just that's just kind of how it comes off to me.
Yeah, and I think there's part of that too is these folks. I mean, I'm going to be blunt. A lot of these folks are just intellectually lazy. They want to outsource their compassion, right? They don't want to help people themselves directly. They don't want to go out and you know, help feed the hungry directly or help, you know, start a charity to pay for people's health insurance to cover, you know, sick children and that sort of thing. They want to just go and hold protest signs and feel better about themselves while not actually doing anything themselves to help people and say, oh, okay, we passed Medicaid expansion. We've got 630,000 people on the Medicaid rolls. They're all taken care of. Everything's great. Look at me. I'm such a wonderful person. You know, I've helped these people. Now I can go home and continue to insulate myself from actually directly interacting with these people in need and feel good about myself. And then you know, go on social media and you know, try to vilify anybody who disagrees with me.
That seems to be the playbook right there. I mean, you just kind of wrapped up the Moral Monday protest in a pretty little bow. And I guess those are going to start up again next month. You know, they're going into session January 10th, and I guess they'll be up and running again, and I'm sure screaming about Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll continue to be on their list. And, you know, I think people who, if they read my articles, they're going to be equipped with a lot more information. A lot of great information, a lot more, you know, reasons and a better understanding of the topic. So then they can have those discussions with those people and present these side of things. And, you know, a lot of them, I'm sure, are just going to be too insulated and not going to want to listen. But hopefully if you can find some of the more reasonable people who are willing to actually engage in a dialogue, you know, maybe you can present the case. And again, I think the best way to appeal to them, which is what, you know, I really focused a lot on in the article, is to say that, you know, hey, you may feel like you're helping out those, you know, less fortunate people, low-income people and so forth, but really you're not, because look at the system, look at the Medicaid program. They're not going to get access to care. It's not going to be helpful for them. Their health outcomes are not going to be improved. You know, there's definitely a better way of doing this to trying to care for them.
Yeah, and the thing that sticks with me as well as that is you mentioned the groups of people that this is intended to help, the pregnant women, the children, I mean, this group of people. And adding on all these working age, able-bodied males stresses the system in a way that reduces the care for the target population. I mean, I'm all for helping people out, but helping people, it's you want to help people who need the help. You don't want to help, I mean, it's not that you don't want to help, but you want to make sure you're doing the best you can for the people you're trying to help. And expanding this to people who could do something for themselves, it gives them the crutch, that gives them a cycle it's hard to get out of, but it also hurts the people you're trying to help in the first place. And that's my concern, is I want the pregnant woman who is in need to be able to get the medical care that she needs to have that healthy child. I want the children who are in a bad situation where they don't have a complete family there providing for them like I had growing up to be able to get medical care. I mean, those are the things those are the high priority. You got to help these people who can't help themselves in that time, in that moment. But putting someone who honestly can get out there and do something on that takes away from the others. I mean, if the system had the capacity, great, but you've laid out just here, and I'm sure in your article way better, made the argument much more convincing, that capacity's not there, that it will stress the system.
Yeah, absolutely right, and that's such a great point to make, especially if you're engaging with these other folks who are, you know, think that Medicaid expansion is the answer to help those in need and everything. Yeah, point out who is going to be crowded out, you know, resources that are going to be diverted away from those more, you know, the most vulnerable populations that you were talking about. And another thing, I mentioned this in my article too, is that the newly eligible people, if Medicaid were to expand, that 630,000 people of newly eligible, you know, able-bodied, largely childless adults, the federal government would be reimbursing the state for 90 cents on the dollar for the expenses of those, versus that traditional Medicaid population we're talking about, federal government reimburses about a third. So, about two-thirds. So it makes, you know, there's the financial incentive then for the state to focus more resources, you know, more dollars towards that newly eligible population, because the feds are going to pay for 90% of their expenses versus only about 65-67% of the traditional Medicaid population. So again, I mean, that there's going to be some financial incentives for resources, more of the resources to flow to that newly eligible population and be taken away from the traditional, more vulnerable populations on Medicaid.
And so if Republicans or conservatives are as heartless as the left says they are, and just so focused on the nickel and the dime and so money focused, they would not want this expansion, because then the money's going to go to the people who are not the target group for this. I mean, that they should be railing against it if they think that the people in power are just going to be so focused on the dollar to do this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in a way, if you want resources to be taken away from the most vulnerable populations in Medicaid, then you should be for the expansion, right? Because that's going to divert more resources, you know, and not only resources and dollars, but again, we're talking about, you know, doctor time. You know, FaceTime with a doctor, space even in the ER. You know, you're going to be flooding those people with, you know, flooding these medical providers with this newly eligible population. And again, that's going to make that, you know, these poor children and pregnant women and so forth, the more vulnerable populations, they're going to be stuck in longer lines, having less access to a regular doctor and so forth. So they're going to be ones that are paying the stiffest penalty for Medicaid expansion.
Oh, yeah. And so to find out about this, they can now go to ncscivitas.org. But the intention is that these will be collected on their own standalone site or a section of the website in the future.
Yeah, we're in the process of constructing a special page, a dedicated page on the Civitas website. I'm sure we'll have a follow-up discussion when that's goes public. But right now, in terms of the Medicaid article itself, you can find it on the front page of the Civitas website, of course, nccivitas.org. And this is part one, largely, that we're discussing. There's also a part two that's going to be posted tomorrow, with a lot of additional information and also some alternatives. So, you know, we're talking about conservative alternatives to, we think, better ways, better means to help out those low-income families that people claim they want to help via Medicaid expansion. We think that there's better alternatives to ensure, you know, good quality health or medical care and health insurance for those folks.
All right. Well, I look forward to reading part two. Thank you for being on the show.
All right. Thank you.
So now I'm joined on the show by Ray Notestein and Brooke Medina. Thank you both for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So we are going to talk about the death penalty, and having been, you know, this is a policy show, it's being driven by something that's happened with our legislative leaders in the state. The leaders of the House and Senate have come on and made a call to resume carrying out the death penalty in the state. There's been no executions in the state since 2006. Sort of a moratorium based on a choked legal system, the Racial Justice Act, and unavailability of doctors because they don't want to participate in trouble getting the drugs, all sorts of things, making a perfect storm of the states not executing anyone. But now with this most recent prison breakout attempt at the Pasquotank County Pasquotank Correctional Institute, a prison down in Pasquotank County, where four inmates started a fire and a riot, killed three corrections workers, three corrections guards, and corrections officers, and then also the manager of the work rehab program, the sewing shop that they were in. So the DA is going for the death penalty, but really what does that mean in a state that's not carrying out executions and hasn't been for a decade? Is it a hollow promise? And should we even have the death penalty? It's kind of what we're here to talk around today. So who wants to start off?
Like you said, this created a perfect storm, with just the questions surrounding having the death penalty in our state with this most recent prison break, have come to the fore because of the severity of these crimes. I mean, these men were, I think you had cited it earlier, none of them were on death row, obviously, and yet they committed this first-degree murder. A couple of these corrections officers did not die immediately. I think they died
later. Right, it was two immediately, and then it was another it was two dead, 10 in critical condition, and then two more died. So now there's also eight other injured people in all of this. And I can do a quick rundown of the inmates that we were talking about beforehand. So there was one who was in there for murder, who was in prison for murder. He was working at a gas station in Charlotte, shot and killed a coworker, and he went to prison for murder. Two of them were in there for attempted murder. One for the attempted killing of a Fort Bragg soldier who was a specialist who was trying to kill the wife of a sergeant. Not sure who he went to the house to kill, but broke into their house, grabbed a kitchen knife, hid in the kitchen, and then stabbed the wife 15 times while they had no idea he was in the home at the time. And he went to prison in the state there for that crime. Instead of going through the military justice system, he went through the North Carolina justice system. And he was in prison for more than 20 years more than 20-year sentence. And then you had also the man who shot a state trooper in the face during a traffic stop in 2013, I think it was. I could be wrong there. 2013, 2014. I remember when that story happened, but it was in the Triangle area. And so you got that one. And then there was the odd man out was a guy who was on a 7-year sentence for burglary, first-degree burglary, who was set to be released next year. So not sure how he got wrapped up in all this. The other guys were 30-year sentences. But anyway, those are the guys.
Right. And so, these were people that were not serving, lifelong sentences. Mm-hmm. I think the most was 30 years. So yeah, it's 32, surprising that they chose to kill people in order to escape, knowing that eventually they are going to be caught and found. I mean, at least you would think they would know that because history has borne that out.
Yeah, I don't know what their plan was when they got out. I mean, none of these guys were criminal enterprise guys, except for maybe the guy who was the burglar. I mean, he seemed to be the only one of those who had any, life of crime. One guy was, like I said, at work at a gas station and went off. One guy had some problem with his sergeant to the point that he wanted to attack him or his family. There's talks of that he may have threatened to kill the sergeant's 3-year-old daughter during this whole attack. And then the other one being someone who got pulled over and had some sort of issue and thought it was, and made a in the moment reaction to attack the police, the state trooper, and shoot the state trooper. So none of these guys were like people who you would expect to be successful after breaking out, like in staying off the radar and living out the rest of their life. And I guess it's hard for any of us to get into the mind of a criminal.
Sure. And prison makes some people more violent. I mean, there's been proven studies that show, confinement, to that nature can increase the violence in somebody and increase the anxiety. And so I think that's something that, we have to think about to some degree in terms of criminal justice reform too, or what are some of the best, not just programs, but what are some of the best ways that you can actually reform somebody in the criminal justice system today.
Right. That's actually a great point, because that is ultimately the goal of anyone who we are planning on letting out of prison, is to reform them. People who have life sentences or people who have death, death sentences. We're not trying to reform those people, but the ones who eventually are to be let out, the goal is to reform them. It's a very good point.
So that actually, makes us, highlight, or it highlights the need, as Ray said, in criminal justice reform, because really would our prisons look like what they currently do, and when we have this much taxpayer money going to prisons, if we actually took an honest look at what is effective in criminal justice reform and whether or not the death penalty is something we actually want to continue to have in our state, and if it is, why are we prolonging these deaths? And there is the moral aspect of this, which I think is most weighty when it comes to this discussion, but also an economic aspect. How much does it cost to keep someone on death row, such as the one that is on death row, has been on death row the longest here in the state of North Carolina, which is
1985. It's Wayne Laws has been on death row since 1985. He's 57 now, and so he's been on death row since he was in his 20s.
That's, in my opinion, that seems unacceptable. If there is enough forensic evidence that proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that he has indeed committed that crime, then we either need to carry out his punishment, or we need to have an honest discussion as to what is an effective punishment for someone that has committed premeditated first-degree murder.
I think Brooke makes a good point. I do think underlying this issue, outside of all the sort of pop culture debates around the death culture, the death penalty that we have, with that Netflix series, The Making of a Murder, and then I know there was a popular podcast on PBS because my wife
Serial.
Serial. My wife was really into it. I mean, I just remember listening to it a little bit and like, oh, this guy's guilty, because I'm always skeptical sometimes of, I'm not going to say it's agenda driven, but sort of you're using a narrative to reshape a previous narrative to some degree. But I do think at the underlying issue of all this, because you've had the rise of the Innocence Project and forensic science over the last few decades, I think that there's an underlying issue with the death penalty that it still has validity, and not from a deterrent perspective, because I think there's a lot of evidence that it doesn't really serve as a strong deterrent. If it serves as a minimal deterrent, that may add to support of the death penalty. But I think underlying all of this still is there's an issue of justice in terms of carrying out a sentence. A state has the right to, I think, decide if it wants to have the death penalty or not. And if it does decide to have that, it needs to be vigorously. That was one of the complaints, right, against Berger. That Berger said is he was disappointed in previous Attorney General Cooper and Stein. But there needs to be a carry out of those sentences that you've mandated by being tried by a jury of their peers and finding them convicted and going through a lengthy. I mean, they get one of the lengthiest appeal processes imaginable. And they go through that entire appeals process. And when it is exhausted, I think it's a sentence that needs to be carried out, because I think there is a justice issue in terms of carrying out that sentence and honoring what the jury decided to do. And I think that's something we all need to think about in this issue. And you can certainly be for or against the death penalty. I think both sides certainly have validity to some extent. But I think from a law enforcement perspective, as the chief law enforcement officer of the state, you need to be vigorous in terms of carrying out those sentences.
I think that as well. I mean, you make a promise, you need to keep it, and it doesn't matter if you're a state who decides not to have the death penalty and you have life sentences, you make that promise, you keep it. And if you decide you want to have the death penalty and then a death sentence is awarded, you have to carry it out so that you're making good on your word. I mean, it's whatever you do, you have to be consistent and you have to do it right. So this, going back to the campaign when our current Attorney General Josh Stein was running, the Republican candidate, Senator Buck Newton, and then Senator Josh Stein both agreed that the death penalty needed to be carried out. They both supported the death penalty. So while there's been no action that I've seen from Stein to try and restart the death penalty, you don't know how much of that was talk and how much of that was what he really believes or but wasn't really looking to act on. You don't know until things happen or overtime don't happen. But one thing he did say was that he wouldn't want caution that we should be careful about how we carry out or how we put forth the death sentence because of things like racial bias in it, which is, that's a whole other conversation. But what I was just kind of saying about being consistent and following through, if you're doing those two things, you're not going to end up in that trap of a mistake. And I can look up the statistics on the breakdown of how our current death row is. It's 143 people on death row, and the majority of them are Black, which it's 77 are Black, 52 are white, 6 are Indian, 5 are other, and that's all the 140 males. And of the females, there's only 3. One is white, one is Black, and one is Indian. So,
well, and like you said, when you're bringing in some of the other conversations that we're having as a society regarding racial justice, that obviously is a component of the death penalty conversation, because sentencing needs to be fair and just and equal, because justice is blind, or it ought to be blind. So that is another conversation, but whatever standard we decide to use, it needs to be applied at all times in our state. And so it needs to be applied fairly, but it also, like you said, needs to be, it needs to have some weight behind it. So if someone gets sentenced to death, such as these four men that attempted to escape the prison in Pasquotank, there actually needs to be something carried out. So I can understand Senator Berger's call for, some weight behind the death penalty. Do these men deserve the death penalty is another question we need to have, or a discussion we need to have, because when you read what actually happened in that attempted prison escape, there were only 2 corrections officers on duty in that bay, where I think there were, I can't remember, dozens of...
30.
30, okay. So 30 men were in there with 2 corrections officers. And obviously none of the corrections officers do not carry weapons with them. And so it's obviously very easy for them to be overpowered. And so was the intent behind the prison escape, was there an intent to kill, or was there an intent to just escape? So that's some nuance in that particular story that is probably going to have to be addressed in the courts before they even entertain the death penalty. I'm not sure, but it's just my thoughts on it.
An interesting fact about the death penalty in the state: we used to put people to death for burglary in North Carolina.
I don't think that's just. What do you guys think about that?
That's a hard sell for me.
Yeah, I think that would be a hard sell for anybody today in our modern society. And I think in some ways we want to be careful in terms of weighing, the past versus today. But it's certainly something that would be a cause for an alarm for today, especially since you have seen successful rehabilitation programs across the nation. I mean, when I was working up the Acton Institute, I went down to Angola Prison, where the average sentence was like 92 or 93 years, interviewed the warden, saw some of the reforms that they were doing. Some of these guys committed heinous acts, when they were like 17, 18, 19, and were in their 80s now. And we're obviously completely different. They're definitely a completely different person when they were 17 or 18. And, I did the tour of the prison entrepreneurship program in Texas and saw some of the great things that they were doing in terms of reforming. Most of them were a little more on the nonviolent side, prisoners, but it was just amazing to see some of the reforms that they did and help people. Because, if you're a prisoner, you get out of prison, you almost have virtually zero chance of getting a job. Mm-hmm. So they were teaching them how to be entrepreneurs and create their own business, or partner along with other business leaders in the Houston community and help them to do great things. So that, to me, was neat. But just getting back to the death penalty issue, so to speak, is, I'll always believe, this is a justice issue, and there are certain crimes that are so heinous that I think do deserve death. Only, from saying that this is unacceptable behavior. If you, torture, abuse, and kill a kid or something, those are instances where I think the death penalty is certainly valid. And I certainly, may not serve as a deterrent to others, but says something about a society that this is completely unacceptable. This will not be tolerated in our state or in our nation. And it really has, they really have become more careful in terms of, you know, because so many states are so scared to execute somebody who may have been innocent. I think there has been a lot of checks and balances than even previous decades now. So, you know, I just go back to the issue of justice, and there are certain crimes that do deserve this sort of penalty.
Well, for me there, I agree with fundamentally should the death penalty exist. I agree it should. But for me, it's sort of a, if there are people who do something so bad and so heinous that they there is no place in society for them. They have no place in any segment of our society. So someone who would do something that awful, that there's no, they cannot be redeemed. There's nothing to redeem left. Someone who would kidnap, rape, and kill a child. There's nothing left for you in our society. I mean, I agree with the death penalty there because there's nothing there to work with. So why, in my mind, why not?
Right. Well, and there is a, if you're a religious person, I am, and I've talked to you guys too, there is a redemptive side on the other side of this life that we hold to, wherein someone, even the worst, can find redemption. But when it comes to the role of government in executing justice, like you said, Ray, there are certain crimes that meet this criteria, which I would say the standard needs to be what we would find in natural law, where there is, if someone so violates another person's personhood, which would be to the extent that they actually took their life in an especially intentional, premeditated, heinous way, they do deserve the death penalty. That's, if I were, you know, if that were my call to make, at least, I believe that's the direction I would go in for justice on behalf of the victim and the victim's families.
Yeah.
But, you know, like we talked about, North Carolina used to allow the death penalty for burglary. That's absurd in my estimation. I know you gave a good warning, Ray, regarding us judging past history in light of our own, you know, wokeness. But, you know, that though was absurd, I would say, because it wasn't proportionate to the crime. I don't feel like that would have even back then been issuing any sort of real justice. Rather, I would say a burglar should compensate the person that they stole from. And if they're unable to compensate them, then they would have to work it off in some other form of labor so as to remedy that. But
yeah, getting back to the redemptive aspect, I think that's important because certainly lots of people on death row are redeemed. You can just go to the Texas death row site. It's part of the Department of Corrections of Texas, and you can read the last statement of every death row inmate that has been executed in the state of Texas. And a lot of them are confessing Christ. A lot of them, you know, there's a few Muslim prisoners that are putting their faith in Allah and Muhammad. So you do see this redemptive aspect of people who have sort of rotted on death row for decades, who have been ministered to by very powerful prison ministries that are available in this nation that serve a very worthy task. So, I mean, I find that aspect interesting of people who have committed very, very violent crimes and have gone on behind bars to lead very, very different lives, to face their own conversion, face some of their own demons, so to speak. So I think that's an important aspect. But I do think there's an aspect where the state has to say, this is unacceptable. I mean, the state's primary duty is to protect the citizenry of this nation. So in protecting the citizen and helping keep them safe, in some instances, I think the death penalty is totally valid.
Absolutely.
Well, all right. Thank you all for coming on this segment. But I'm going to leave you with two interesting facts. So the burglary, the last person to be put to death for burglary in the state, 1949.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Post-World War II.
Post-World War II, we put someone to death for burglary in the state. It's shocking to me. And the last person to be put to death by a method not lethal injection in the state was 1998.
What method was it?
Gas. Thank y'all again for coming on this episode. Thank you to Brooke and Ray for coming on the show and sharing their thoughts with us about the death penalty. We'll catch you next time.